By March, Catherine had cheered considerably. "I'm sitting up for a few minutes today," she wrote proudly to Pearl. "And, oh, how good it feels after so long in bed." Leonard Grossman had not seen his bed for a very, very long time, or so it seemed. Throughout February and March, there was a convoluted exchange of briefs as he and Majid duelled with pen swords in further book-length submissions to Marvel. "He worked around the clock for a week," said Grossman's son. "He had three or four secretaries in." This crack team of assistants took dictation as Grossman paced his office or sat in his big chair with a cigar and reeled off the brilliant oratory for which he was famous. "I have been busy day and night," Grossman later wrote to Pearl, "working on the radium case." On 28th of March, 1938, the final brief was filed. After consideration of this, Marvel would deliver his verdict. In it, Grossman denigrated the company's shameful, shifting defence and what he called the cesspools in respondents' alibis, and continued, "Language can coin no fitting words of odium with which to condemn the cool, calculating radium dial company. Workers were lulled into a false sense of security by dastardly and diabolical false and fraudulent misrepresentations. The company knew, he wrote, the legal duties which it owed its employees and murderously refused them. Its officials repeatedly lied to Catherine to induce her and other employees to remain quiescent and not aroused and not aware of her true condition. They had, he said, betrayed her." He did not mince his words. "I cannot imagine a fiend fresh from the profoundest depths of perdition committing such an unnatural crime as the Radium Dial Company did. My God! Is the radium industry utterly destitute of shame? Is the Radium Dial Company utterly dominated by a beast? It is an offence against morals and humanity," he concluded, "and, just incidentally, against the law." He wrote powerfully. The judge had declared that he would not make a final ruling until 10th of April. Yet on Tuesday the 5th of April, the telephone burred in Grossman's office. He was summoned to the headquarters of the IIC at 205 West Wacker Drive, just around the corner from the Metropolitan Building. The verdict was in. Chapter 54. There was no time to tell the Donoghues. Grossman managed to summon those few former dial painters now living in Chicago, Charlotte Purcell and Helen Munk, and they alone were able to reach the hearing in time. It was held just before noon. Helen was nervously smoking a cigarette as they all crowded into the wood-panelled IIC room to hear the verdict. George Marvel's judgment was read aloud by the chairman of the commission. Both Majid and Grossman stood to hear him speak. The two attorneys sized each other up as the chairman called for silence. Mrs. Donoghue, Marvel had written, was suffering from a disease that was slow, insidious in its nature, progressive and extending over a long period of years. He concluded, "The disablement sustained made Mrs. Donoghue incapable of following any gainful occupation." Those in the court shifted restlessly. They knew all this. The question was, would he find the company at fault? The written judgment proceeded. "The Industrial Commission finds that a relation of employer and employee existed between the company and the plaintiff. Catherine Donoghue's disability did arise out of and come in the course of her employment. He had found the company guilty.